Hello and welcome back to the Not So Alpha Males podcast, brought to you by your host, me, Toby.
And me, Tom.
And we're basically two cool nerds that try and delve into the world of science, psychology, and basically everything in between. We usually do every other Thursday, but we were very busy.
That didn't age well, did it?
No, to be honest, once lockdown's eased a bit, we realised we've got lives to live as well, which we had a nice little date out in London, didn't we?
We
Got some
did.
nice
That was a
couple
cute little
photos.
day. That was a nice, Maybe we should post one of those photos on the Instagram for people to see how we are in real life.
The dream couple, the power
The
couple.
couple goals. Anyway, we were very busy, and unfortunately we didn't have time for research, recording, editing, stuff like that. But we're here now. We didn't go anywhere. We weren't leaving. We're sticking this out.
I'm proving to you guys that I'm still committed because I've upgraded my mic. So I'm hoping
Yes.
I'm going to be sounding better because I did get a few complaints about my audio. So I thought I'd bite the bullet and upgrade, and hopefully I'll be sounding better to you guys. But I don't know if better is the right word because you might not like
ASMR, man.
my.
That's what we'll do next. ASMR. Should we get into the topics this week? What are you doing?
So this week, I'm going to be talking to you guys about Starlink and SpaceX. What is it, what it's for, and potential problems that might occur because of it. What are you bringing?
Okay. I'm going for more of a psychology route this week. I'm going to
Oh,
be
nice.
doing dreams. I'm doing a little bit of like what they physically are, what's going on in the old brain, because I'm quite obsessed with the brain apparently
Yeah,
over the
you
last
like the
few
brain.
weeks. But also, let's psychoanalyze you later. How's your sleeping going and that kind of thing? But we'll
Oh,
get into that.
delving deep into it like we do on this podcast. And
Boom.
of course, we'll be drinking cocktails throughout. So this week, I've gone for a nice rosé sangria, which, I mean, it's not a cocktail, to be honest, but it's a sangria and I feel fantastic for making it. I've got some berries in there. I've got some mint. Like, I even bought a mint plant yesterday and I've got mint from
Just for
that.
this.
Yeah, organic, mate,
God,
organic.
wow. Yeah, fresh.
I've got a whole jug of it. So yeah, it's very good. What have you got?
Before I go on to mine, is there different types of sangria then? Because I've only just liked sangria, but you said rosé sangria. So it's like white sangria, one we made white wine, and then like red wine
Well, yeah, and this was made
alternatives.
with rosé
I didn't
wine.
know that. I've only ever seen like sangria
Yeah,
and like not
well,
like a.
normal sangria is red sangria, I think, but I'm
Ah,
not a
yes,
massive red wine drinker. So, and it's a very not so alpha males, isn't it? Having a rosé sangria. I don't think you can get more
True,
not so alpha males than
true,
that.
true.
What have you got?
I've gone for a whiskey sour.
Oh, nice.
So a little bit of bourbon in there, lemon juice, some egg whites. You did an egg white one week, didn't you?
Does it make it frothy?
Just make it frothy, nice and
Nice.
frothy on top.
That's what we like.
So
Are you enjoying
that's what I'll
it?
be drinking. It's very, very good.
Oh,
I'm
good.
liking it. I like
Good.
whiskey.
All
So
good vibes,
all
man.
kinds of all good vibes here, yeah. Right, let's get into
So if you're listening to this podcast, you obviously have or have had some kind of internet connection. Is that fair to say, Tom?
Yeah, we're not going
Yeah.
out on radio, are we yet? We're not that
No,
big.
not yet, but give it
No.
time. Give it time.
One day.
And depending on the area, you might have faster speeds, better than other people, but you generally have internet and that kind of improves everything. So it lets you work from home. It means you can Netflix and chill in the evenings, which I know you like to do, Tom. And it lets you sad because you don't get to do
Weird joke.
that
You can't put
at all. You don't
that
get to do that at all. Anyway, it opens up the door for so much. But did you know 41.3% of the world actually doesn't have any internet access at all?
Wow,
Yeah, so
that's quite a
that's
lot, actually.
quite a lot of people.
Is that based on the number of people or just the actual land mass?
Number of people, I assume.
Okay, I'm just trying to clarify for our listeners, they might go into work tomorrow and use this stat, and you never, and like, I want them to be correct.
all right, fair enough. And that's where SpaceX comes in with their Starlink. So, what is Starlink? What is the latest news about it? Where is it going to go? Why should you care? They're kind of the things I'm going to try and rattle off. So places like Africa, the Middle East and Asia, they're lagging quite far behind the likes of Europe and North America in the sense that laying long cables in remote regions. So in Africa, there's a lot of open land. It costs a fortune and there's a low number of potential customers because people live in cities, really. So all the people in the rural areas aren't getting any internet. And that's quite a lot of people. And, you know, even in the UK, if you're in a rural area, there's estimated 80% coverage over the whole of the UK for rural areas. So still 20% of people.
I was actually looking at one place and houses and on some of like the when you're shopping for a house or whatever, it'll tell you like the internet speeds of that area. And it was 7 megabytes per second.
Well, my mum's house gets like 10, which is...
So you're on 10 right now?
I'm not at my mum's house. So no, I don't have that.
Well, yeah, look, you moved out then because our audience doesn't know this.
Yeah, I'm living somewhere else, which I'm not going to specify because I don't want our super fans to track me down.
Exactly, we're getting too big now.
But yeah. you still live with your mum, don't you?
Yes, yeah, yeah. Mum and dad. But hopefully in a couple of weeks, I'll be back up to a non-disclosed location. Because I too do not want to reveal my location on here.
Good.
So 2 weeks.
2 weeks. Anyway, going off topic. So 80% of rural areas in the UK don't get good coverage or any. The US is actually even more. So 61% of rural areas don't really get any internet coverage. And satellite internet services basically come in and solve that problem because satellites up in space, they cover a large cone of area so people can get internet.
Cone of area? You know what, Toby?
Oh, fuck you.
I'm not familiar with that measurement.
Okay,
can you please elaborate?
Because they can cover large areas, obviously, because the single satellite would be up in the space and it can...
Talking like a four-year-old. It's up in the space and then we're down here on the Earth.
Hey, I'm seriously listening.
I'm so sorry. It's just making me laugh. Oh.
Anyway, so... people in rural areas can get internet, but they basically are on geostationary orbits. Do you know what that means, geostationary?
It stays in the same place as the Earth rotates.
Nice. And how does it do that?
Mm. Jetpack kind of thing, I don't know.
Okay. Yeah, so basically geostationary, you're right, it stays in the same kind of location in the sky, and that's because it goes up to an altitude of around 22,000 miles. Or 36,000 kilometers, and at a certain speed where it's constantly falling at the same rate as the Earth spinning, so it ends up staying in the same place.
Mm, that does basically mean that the Earth is round and not flat, then.
Yeah.
Seeing as that actually works, just want to point that out to any flat Earther believers.
Yeah, I think there's a potential topic there with flat Earthers, but you know, future.
Mm.
We'll write that one down. So, because of geostationary orbit, it has to be really high up in the sky to match that because you can only go one speed of like the Earth's rotation, right? So it has to go up to a certain altitude to match it. But because that distance is so large, do you think that causes any problems with like internet?
I mean, I don't really know how it beams the internet down, to be honest. That bit always I don't understand that. I don't know if you're going to go into that bit later, but I presume because it's so far away and it's beaming it down, it's very... course when it eventually reaches the actual surface of the Earth.
Yeah, so it's basically, it's more of the latency that's the bigger issue with this. It's not the amount of internet, even though that can be a problem, but it's the lag. So basically your computer, if you're using it for the internet, it'll beam a radio signal up to the satellite. Obviously there's a time delay, so it takes about 120 milliseconds to reach that geostationary satellite.
Wow, that's very slow.
But that's just to reach it, and then obviously another 120 to get back.
For a reference, I think like down here on Earth, in the normal cable way, it's like 10 milliseconds.
No, well, you'd be doing work if it was 10. I think it's usually around like 30 milliseconds.
I've got great internet here, then. What can I say?
But yeah, so it's at least 240 milliseconds, but because of inefficiencies and things, it can take about 400 to 600 milliseconds. Doesn't sound a lot, but in terms of internet usage, like, you wouldn't ever be able to play a game on that if you're into gaming or something, because it would just be so stuttery and painful. But if you were like streaming something, wouldn't be that much of an issue, because you don't need that refresh speed. Anyway, so this 400, 600 milliseconds, about 12 times slower than what you usually see on the ground. And on top of this, you have this problem with bandwidth. So a single satellite can only handle so much. So if there's loads of people trying to beam up to it, then you're kind of splitting that much internet to all these different people. So you might have slow speeds. But if you're in a rural area and this is all you've got, what else can you do? So basically, SpaceX has come in with their Starlink product, and there's not much competition as of yet, and there's some big technical issues to solve. They've come in and they're trying to do it differently. Do you have any idea of how they're planning to do it differently?
No, I don't really know much about Starlink and stuff, so.
Well, that's good. So basically, Starlink are planning to use much lower orbit constellations of satellites. So they're aiming to be about 1/100th of the height of geostationary orbits. There are currently around 1,300 Starlink satellites already in orbit as of today. And they're about 350 miles above the surface. So compare that to the 22,000 miles that the geostationary ones are. It's quite a difference.
My engineering brain is telling me that's a lot more difficult to do than something further out in terms of the amount of energy required to keep it up.
It's more the fact that you need to fire them at faster speed. So then you're falling and you're not hitting into the ground. You're always falling away from the Earth, if that makes sense. It's hard to do it on a podcast. You kind of have to watch a video on how satellites fall.
Right.
Because they are always falling. Like the International Space Center, that's always falling. And when you see astronauts in like floating around, they are still falling down to Earth. But because they're moving so fast across the sky, they're always falling, so and they feel weightless. Anyway, so yeah, you need a lot more energy to basically get them up to speed at this orbit. So they fired around 1,300, as I said, but they're planning a total of 4,400 in their phase one, and around the year 2027 they'll have nearly 12,000 satellites deployed in like three different shells. So they've got 340 kilometers, 550 kilometers, and another one 1,000 kilometers. And on top of that, they're also planning to add an additional 30,000 satellites beyond that.
What? So there's gonna be like no space left in space around the Earth.
So I'm gonna put that into perspective. There are currently around 3,000 to 5,000 satellites in total around Earth today, and we've in total launched around 9,000 satellites in the history of mankind. So we're basically going to fire more satellites in the space of 10 years than we are going to have in the whole history of mankind, which is pretty crazy. And the reason why they're going to fire so many satellites is because they're so low down, much closer to Earth, and they've got to travel faster. They've also got a smaller cone of coverage, so they need a lot more of them to span out across the Earth so people can get internet coverage and it doesn't just drop out all the time. But do you know why they're trying to have a low Earth orbit instead of geostationary? Any ideas from what I told you?
So it's a lower latency and better speeds of the internet.
Yes. So by having it so much lower, they can get a latency of around like 25 to 30 milliseconds. So kind of like normal speeds at home, really, for people in the middle of nowhere that beams it all the way up to space and back. It's pretty crazy.
This has to be like the future, doesn't it, of internet, rather than cabling it all.
So, no.
Oh.
The answer.
Fair enough.
So, it depends on where you live, because if you're living in a city, like a lot of the population of the world does, your internet will be cheaper to just wire a few in the area that you are.
Yeah.
But if you've got to then do miles and miles to get to one house, it makes no sense to do that. So for rural areas, like I said at the beginning, it's perfect for cities, probably not much point.
Right.
Another thing that they do, which is quite cool, is they plan to have lasers on them so they can communicate with each other, the satellites. So it means that you can actually get speeds faster there than you can actually on Earth in terms of latency. And that is because the speed of light in a vacuum is 47% faster than it is in glass. So if you've got a fiber optic and you've got to send information across a big distance, the time that it would take for the message to go up to the satellite, beam it across to another one and down would be less than it would take to go along the fiber optic. So again, that's right, for like okay. big distance communications. So like London to Singapore or something like that, you'd get a much bigger latency. If you use the satellites, you'd get much less, which is quite cool. Bit of physics for you there.
There's like stock markets and all sorts will like to start trading on a much faster.
Yeah, I'm going to come into that because that is an interesting one, but not yet. Hold your horses. So each satellite can handle 1 terabyte per second of internet, which is almost 4 times the capacity of the competitors in the geostationary ones. And to put that to scale, it's basically 40,000 people streaming 4K video all at once. That's how much internet one satellite can take, which sounds pretty good.
Oh, okay. Right. Sorry, I was thinking people will get 1 terabyte internet on Earth from that. Oh, okay. Okay. Do you know what the speed will be that they could get?
Yeah, so they've got a beta going at the moment. So people in the UK and the US have actually been able to use it, which is really cool. So have a look on like YouTube and stuff of people Starlink, because you get, you know, like a Sky dish on the side of your house, you kind of get one of them, which is like really cool design on it, and it tracks the satellites in the sky and it gives you internet. But I think you get competitive speeds, not crazy, like you get like 50 megabytes per second maybe.
Oh, that's still good.
And it's that's a beta, so it's always going to be improving, but don't quote me on that number.
And is it like free? I don't know why I've got this mind in my
No, it's not free.
Is it not? Oh, it's actually like a... I don't know why I had something about... I swear I read something like Elon Musk giving internet to the world for free or something like that. But no, you have to pay for it like any other kind of provider.
You basically spend 500 quid on getting the dish, like an upfront cost, and then you pay like a monthly fee for the internet. Right. But obviously the cost for the dish will come down as production ramps up because of economies of scale and stuff. But yeah, that's all in beta at the moment, and it's coming back with pretty good results. And it's for like people are testing it in situations which it's not really designed for, like in cities and things like that. So like when you're watching it, bear in mind that aspect of it. But yeah, so it serves 40,000 people, 4K video all at once, which sounds good. But when you think of like a city, you might have like 1 million people in that city. That's still not going to be enough. So again, it reinforces the fact it's not for that. But there's also this other potential use, which you've highlighted just earlier, which is for trading. So there's a thing called high frequency trading, which I've never heard of before. And it's basically an automated trading platform that large investment banks and hedge funds use. And they use complex algorithms to analyze markets, and they use them to like spot emerging trends in fractions of a second. So they recognize the shift, and the trading system then sends hundreds of like stocks out to make money from the market and stuff. And it's all like really milliseconds matter. So the currently they use advanced fiber optics to shave like a few milliseconds off. But as I said, the laws of physics, if you're from New York to London, they've got a massive under ocean cable.
Cool.
Yeah, they've got loads of cables under the oceans and things. That's how they connect them all. And that light travels at 47% slower than it does in space. So if you could send that data up into space, across to another satellite, laser that information, and then down to London, then you're like saving milliseconds on that. So apparently it's like a big thing. It could be a big thing with high frequency trading, because every second counts on it.
It's part of the hustle.
Yeah, I thought that was pretty cool, because
that is sick. Yeah.
Not something I thought about with this kind of thing. Anyway, so SpaceX, they're known for sending up rockets as of now. Like when you watch it on YouTube, it's always them just sending up rockets and doing something with their Starship and that lot. And they make about $3 to $5 billion a year in their revenue. But this Starlink opportunity, they reckon they could bring in $30 to $50 billion a year of revenue with it. So
wow,
and they see it as basically their way to generate money to then develop more advanced rockets and get to Mars, basically, at the end of the day. And if you want to know about getting to Mars, listen to episode 4. Shameless plug there.
Shameless.
But yeah, so it's a massive money earner for them. It wouldn't be a free thing at all. And there's other big companies looking at this as well. So Amazon, Jeff Bezos, they're planning to send about 3,000 satellites up into space. And OneWeb, they've sent about 140 odd currently. They're the only ones that I think that have sent up something for this kind of thing against Starlink.
Is this some kind of like board or organization that you have to go to ask to do this? Because there has to be a point where there's not enough sky, or they're going to start hitting into each other. If like Bezos is doing it, Musk is doing it, like all these different organizations do it, it's just going to cause havoc.
Yeah. So basically the US Space Force, which I think is still so fucking cool that they call it that, they track a lot of these objects. So they track every satellite that's in the sky, some debris, broken satellites, objects and things, but up to a certain size, and they're always tracking it. So they basically alert companies, which I'll get to in a second, if they're on a collision course, which has happened in the past. So yeah, I'll get to that.
Yeah, because I saw there's a picture, very famous picture, I think, which we should put on the Instagram for this week's episode, of something tiny, like a bullet-sized piece of metal hitting a sheet of metal in space at, like, I don't know, some stupid 13,000 kilometers a second or whatever it was. And it's like a massive impact into this sheet of, like, it's almost like a massive brick of metal.
Yeah.
And I can imagine, yeah, no, Starlink satellites hitting into each other is going to cause absolute chaos. But yeah, we'll definitely post that picture because it's kind of crazy.
Yeah, because this, like, the space station has actually almost been evacuated because of that, because they had potential space debris that would come into contact with the space station, which would then cause a catastrophic failure for it. So because it's traveling so fast, it could literally just go straight through. And
what does an evacuation of the space station look like? Do they just go out in space for everyone and wait? So like, I can't believe they can get a rocket up quick enough and down again.
No, they don't do that. They sit in the capsule. So they're literally all there in the capsule to go back to Earth. And then if they get told, yeah, shit, get going, then they'll eject and fly back down. So yeah, the concerns is about all this overcrowding that is happening. And there's two big issues here. One of them is actually the effect on astronomy. So there's a bit of an uproar in the astronomy community, which, because the satellites fly quite low to the ground and the materials they're made from, they're extremely bright, which they're actually brighter than 99% of the objects in orbit currently. And they can actually be visible to the unaided eye. So you can actually see them up in the sky.
Oh.
And due to there being so many of them, like, you can imagine if there's 30,000 satellites flying around up there and they're always going to be flying around the Earth really quickly, they're just going to ruin astronomy for people because they'll just see these little things all the time. And for people that, you know, amateurs that want to take photos of the sky, it's annoying. But like for the professionals that actually use the proper big telescopes, like if they're recording data and they've got these satellites flying past all the time, it can cause a lot of noise. To be fair to SpaceX, they've been working on it, so they've painted sections of it black to stop reflecting the light as much, or they've adjusted the orientation to minimize how much light is actually caught by the satellite and then reflected back down. They've even added a sunshade to the satellites to try and reduce it. So they're trying their best, but they're still going to be flying around. And the other issue is the amount of satellites there are and the potential for space debris. So every rocket we launch and every satellite we launch, we're basically creating this trap for ourselves that is actually getting worse and worse every time we do it. And it could be potentially so bad that we end up being trapped on our planet for like decades to centuries. Sounds pretty scary.
This is like the film WALL-E. You know, have you seen it?
Yeah.
Great film where like they have to leave Earth because of all the rubbish, and then you see them leaving and they like smash through all the debris in space.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. But in real life, all the debris would be flying at like 30,000 kilometers an hour instead of just sitting there.
Right, fair enough.
But yeah, so it's exactly like that. I thought you were going to mention a different film, actually, which was Gravity. But have you seen Gravity?
I have, but I'm a bigger fan of WALL-E. Well,
did you know it was rated as one of the best love films in the history?
Yeah, true. I can see why.
Well, he travels across the whole universe for this little robot. Right, so...
You know, you should just talk about WALL-E for like a whole hour, one episode.
So after decades of travel, there's vent boosters up there. Admittedly, now we're being able to land the boosters back, which is helpful. But there's dead satellites, millions of pieces of shrapnel. So there's 2,600 dead satellites, apparently. 10,000 objects bigger than a screen. 20,000 as large as an apple. 500,000 the size of a marble. And they reckon at least 100 million so small that they can't be tracked. Pieces already up there.
Who's putting all this up there?
Well, we are. Well, not us, the Americans, but the Americans
Jesus
and the Russians.
Christ.
Yeah, and that's all moving really fast. So circling the Earth, different trajectories, different orbits and things like that.
So what you're saying is as well, Superman film completely unrealistic then, because he'd just die as soon as he went up.
Well, it's not that bad yet. You've got to think the space is still very big. So yeah, you've got to bear that in mind. And we've basically putting $1 trillion infrastructure right in that death zone, pretty much.
That's kind of crazy.
Yeah, and apparently there's actually 3 or 4 satellites destroyed every year because of the space debris.
Wow.
Yeah.
Damn.
Which is a lot of money. You think, like, how much
That's
satellites
so
cost.
So much money being burnt up, yeah.
So, and as the amount of satellites grow, this rate that's crazy in the next 10 years, it could be approaching a tipping point.
It sounds like we need to first clean space up and then go about putting some nice shiny satellites up there everywhere.
Yeah.
Like, this seems a bit stupid. This seems like we're just going to then start making plastic islands in the sea, which is already full of plastic. That's a terrible analogy.
Episode 7.
That one. Yeah, I was doing it for the link. Yeah, you're right. Shameless. But it just seems so stupid. Like, it just seems like if there's 30,000 up there, just going to be losing 1,000 a year because of all the crap going up there, which then makes more crap. And then they send more up, and then there's more. And it's just like some terrible feedback loop.
Yeah.
I don't think they've figured this out very well. I don't think they thought it through.
They haven't. From researching this, it has got me, like, worried in the sense that this is actually a realistic danger. And I'll tell you, like, how bad it can get in a second. So last month, March the 30th, OneWeb sent a batch of satellites up there. So SpaceX's competitor. And they got the notification from the US Space Force that there could be a possible collision with a Starlink satellite. And this is because OneWeb's constellation is at a higher altitude than the SpaceX's one. So they have to go through the constellation of SpaceX. And they got told that there was a probability of 1.3%, which doesn't sound a lot, but 1 in 100 are still, and you think these satellites are millions and millions of dollars, you wouldn't really want to take that risk. Anyway, they came as close as 190 feet from hitting each other, which is nothing in terms of space. Like, that's nothing. Well, the problem is there's no national or global authority that can force satellite operators to take action. So the Space Force can't legally say to OneWeb, you need to move, or SpaceX, you need to move. They just can, like, advise them.
It sounds like we need that. We need some sort of global
And program. What SpaceX did, they have an automated AI-powered collision avoidance system, and they turned it off.
Cool name.
So when they got told, they never commented, but I basically think it's a flex because it made OneWeb then have to alter the satellite's direction, because SpaceX just were like, we're gonna turn it off and just see what happens, and OneWeb are like, we can't really afford to lose this one, so we're gonna have to
Would OneWeb have to pay SpaceX if they smashed into theirs?
I don't know, it'd be a legal battle. But so they turned it off and they never said why. So it's basically a flex, because they're like, yeah, we're not going to move for you. You have to move for us. But would it be that bad if one satellite crashed into another?
I assume the short answer is yes.
Yes, it would be
very... It must fall to Earth. No, maybe, I don't know.
No, so what actually happens in space is that if a satellite hits each other, they just go straight through each other because they're so fast. They don't just hit and then fall down, and it turns itself into like a shotgun, basically, of all the different pellets. And where that can then cause a collision cascade, which is basically one of them smashes into another one, creates loads of these bullets, which then flies into all the other ones, which then creates all more bullets. And then you get this exponential effect, which destroys basically everything. And that's in the film Gravity. So if you watch that again, I think it's a Russian missile destroyed a Russian satellite, which was gone off. And it caused so much debris that then it hit into another satellite, which hit into another satellite, and then ended up destroying everything in orbit. And
crazy. Isn't it funny that we have those problems today on Earth?
But you don't really, it doesn't seem like it's a problem, but it will be for sure in the next 10 years. If something happens, all it takes is one rogue satellite getting hit by something, which then knocks it. And then if that happens...
There's 30,000 up there.
Yeah, and what might happen is it might take a long time. So by one satellite hitting into another one, it creates loads of debris, but space is big. It might mean that in 5 years' time, that debris then ends up making five satellites crash out. And then in 5 years' time, make 10. But then because of exponential, it will literally just all of a sudden be like 50, and then everything's gone. So some say we might already be past the point of that we've got too much stuff up there.
Oh, so it's already in that.
It could be.
Profile of it going upwards.
Yeah, and it's...
That's why we've got to clean it up, bro. That's my new initiative in life. We need to clean space.
How would you do it, though?
Yeah, that's a good question. That's a good question.
Because there are...
Have you looked at that this week, or no? That's a bit outside of the topic, I guess.
I've touched upon it. So this is my last little bit of, what are we planning to do about it? How are we going to clean up space, as you said? And there's ideas that they're working on. So they can harpoon dead satellites, for one. So you launch a satellite with a harpoon on it, and then you fire it at a big boy satellite.
Big boy. These are all very technical terms and the actual correct engineering terms, I have to say.
And then the small satellite deploys a big parachute in space. And because there's still tiny bits of atmosphere, it slows it down and brings it down into the atmosphere and burns up. So that's one idea, but that's obviously only for big satellites. You can't do that.
Not like those tiny apple-sized things. Yeah.
There's also other ideas of using magnets, so having a big magnetic source and repelling all the metal down onto Earth, which means it would burn up. Another idea would be to use lasers to try and disintegrate all the tiny little millions of pieces. So you'd send a satellite up and shoot lasers at it. I mean, it sounds pretty far-fetched in my opinion, but I think that the million pieces of small bits, I don't know how you'd solve, really.
Because it's there forever now.
Well, eventually they might fall down, but because they're so small, they're not going to have that much drag in the tiny bits of atmosphere up in orbit. So they could be there for hundreds of years and then we could be stuck. And it could be another great filter, like I mentioned before in that Fermi Paradox episode. Hey,
oh my God, right. Seriously, we need to stop with the references back.
No, but it's true though. We could end up being trapped on Earth because of all the space debris.
God, we fucked the Earth up and now we've fucked space up. Honestly, we shouldn't go to Mars because we will mess Mars up, even though it's terrible already.
I feel like every topic I'm just slating us big time, but it's a pretty awesome thing, the Starlink, but also pretty
terrifying.
That was
fascinating as hell, that topic, to be fair. I loved it.
Yeah, it's good, but scary at the same time. Yeah, I've finished my glass of sangria, so I'm just going to get another one. Give me one second. All right, mate. You can sing to our listeners again.
Oh, God, we drank too much last week.
Right, I'm back after my refill of my sangria. So over to you, Tom.
Yeah, I'm going to be doing dreams this week and fairyland and all that kind of thing. So,
oh, okay, nice.
As you will know, because I assume you dream, as do I, that dreams are essentially stories and images that our minds create while we sleep. A state of consciousness that is categorized by having basically all kinds of sensory attributes that your brain can perceive. So compared to like, and this is what fascinates researchers so much about dreams, is because compared to daydreaming, or when you're thinking and imagining something like that, dreams also tap into the other senses. So smell, touch, pain, taste, like you feel things in your dream. It's not just you imagining you walking down a street, like you can feel a breeze in your face, like you don't question the physics of it. So it's a very, very in-depth kind of reality that our brain somehow can make from nothing, essentially.
Do you know what I find about weird about dreams is, like, I don't know about you, but there's sometimes things just don't make sense when you think about them when you're awake. Like in my dream, I was in my bedroom, and then all of a sudden I was at my desk. But like from that transition, it's just like, oh yeah, that's fine. Just
happened. Yeah, well, there is a, I have an actual explanation for that.
Brilliant.
So you got to wait for that, because it's to do with which, I mean, the brain is active throughout all your sleep. But when you start dreaming, different parts of the brain are active in different ways. And for that example you just brought up, the logical reasoning part of your brain goes really, really quiet during dreams. That's why you don't question all the craziness that goes on, because your frontal lobe has gone to sleep. So it's just like, it's not questioning that you can fly or whatever's going on. It's just like, yeah, I'll take it as it is kind of thing. So that's exactly what's happening when you're just going from one room to another. Your brain doesn't really think about what real life physics is like anymore until you wake up and it switches back on. It goes, what the hell was that?
Yeah. Like it felt so real at the time, but
yeah.
How the hell did that happen?
Yeah. So, yeah, so it's, I mean, I'm sorry, I'm actually plugging it myself now. Going back to the simulation theory episode.
Oh.
Our dreams are essentially the best kind of simulation that we can come up with at the moment. Kind of like the perfect VR, so to speak. Albeit with the weird storylines that we have during them. Interestingly, blind people actually dream more with the other senses than they do with the visual one. So for the majority of people, the visualization is the biggest part of the dream, like you're seeing something and what's going on. But blind people, the other senses are heightened, so to speak. So you know that kind of, I don't know if it is a myth or not, but when you lose one of the senses, the others get heightened. Is it a fact? I actually don't know.
I think like if you're like caveman times, if you couldn't see, the only way you'd survive is your other instincts, wouldn't it?
That's true.
You'd assume so, it'd be a fact. Maybe,
yeah. Okay. Let's go with fact then.
Let's go for it. Maybe not say fact actually.
Yeah. Don't fact check us, guys, please. So yeah, the exact same happens then to people who have lost senses in dreams. The other ones will be heightened, and their whole story will, I don't know, taste better or whatever. Yeah.
So with people that obviously can't see, so like blind people and things, the ones that lost their sight at birth, would they dream of visual things even though they've never seen anything before? Or like, I get it if someone's gone blind in life because you know what things look like, but what would it look like if you never
That's
seen?
That's an amazing question, because as I was going to get into, your dreams are like it's your subconscious and conscious meeting, essentially. So all the things that happen to you consciously, your subconscious kind of picks apart, and that's what builds a dream. So you know that classic thing of when you wake up and you're telling someone about a dream, and it's like, you were there, you were in the dream, but it wasn't quite you. Like, I knew it was you, but you didn't look like you, or you didn't talk like your dream or whatever manufactures the dream pulls on what's in your brain. And I guess for someone who's never seen before, that's a really interesting question. I have no idea. I presume they don't have much visual stuff in their dreams.
Yeah, what would they work with?
Yeah. I mean, that's got, yeah. I don't know. That's a great question. I should actually look that up after.
I think maybe, actually, thinking about it, I'm assuming they can visualize stuff by touch. So you'd feel like
Yeah, that's true.
So
yeah,
you'd probably dream without colors, but you dream of like objects, maybe. I don't know.
Well, that's another big thing. I mean, and this goes for all people, some people dream in colour, some people dream in black and white, and no one knows why. I don't know about you. I'm a colour dreamer.
I've never thought about it, to be honest.
Yeah,
I have to think about it. I'll come back on a couple of weeks' time.
Yeah, but people change. Regarding to that, it can change over your life as well. So like when you get older or when you were younger, you were one way and then you grew out of it and you then went to black and white or you went to colour or something like that. So things are constantly changing in your brain, which is why I think I like it so much, because it's like the most unknown thing. Mm. And what's amazing is there is no other human state that has been as extensively studied as dreaming. So all the research that we've ever done about people being awake or say in a coma, whatever kind of state their brain's in, dreams have been the most extensively studied. And this goes back to like ancient civilizations, another plug, and ancient civilizations. And they just come to me when I say it and I feel really stupid anyway. Yeah, they would write down their dreams as like ancient Egyptian scripts where you can see people talking about dreams and things like that. So very, very fascinating area.
Hmm.
And today there are two approaches to the study of dreams. One is the neuroscientific path, where, you know, they're obviously more focused on the structures and what's going on, the brain activity, what things are lighting up, what's not, you know, that electrical signal stuff I was talking about. And then the other half, don't ruin it with the laugh.
Sorry.
Don't make the plug.
I'm just trying to not plug.
And then the other half is the psychoanalysts, and they're concentrating on like the meaning of dreams and why do we dream and sort of the weird abstractness of what we're dreaming. How's that been formed from our memories and our associations and things like that? So those are the two kind of pathways that have been focusing on it.
So that second one, I know there's people that say, oh, you've dreamt of a flying dog, that means you're unsettled at work, like, and like put random things together. Like, do you believe in any of that stuff from what your research? Or
I actually am going to get into some of the more common dreams that, because
so running away a lot, isn't it? Or something.
Yeah. Like, so like, I mean, running downstairs. There's like being chased is a big one. Yeah. And so there's, we dream a lot, and I'll get into how much we actually dream in a second. But we forget 95% of our dreams and only actually remember about 5% of them. So it's also difficult to know what these all dreams are. But those ones that are always common where, like, I don't know, teeth falling out. I've had that one numerous times with stress.
I have it all the time. I was going to come up with it. Like, so I'll come back to that.
There are ones that we all share and that we can all kind of, and even though in your dream, your subconscious is picking your own self-image, and I've had my own self-image, the dream theme is the same. So we can share that. But the majority of dreams actually are completely different. Like, it's what your subconscious is picking from your random memories and things. Like, we won't share the dreams or anything like that. But there are some themes that do crop up when you are studying this area.
I've got a question. I don't know. You've got a lot of questions
so far.
I do. It's fascinating. It's really fascinating. Could you dream of someone's face when you've never seen them before? Or is everyone in your dream people that you've met?
Well, the studies that I've read about suggest once you've seen someone, whether they're walking down the street or whatever, and you might not have actually, like, your brain, your conscious brain might not have realized you've seen that person. You know, you walk down the street, you see 1,000 faces a day. For them to appear in a dream typically takes 5 to 7 days later. So there's a really weird, and it's very difficult to study this whole thing. So nothing's known absolutely, but there is a really weird connection between memory and dreaming. And that's, I'm going to come into a bit more on that as well, because that's why you can't remember 95% of your dreams, because of how they're sort of filed, so to speak, into your brain. They're not the same as a memory, so you can't recall them in the same kind of way. So that's very good. But I mean, I don't think, you can't invent something without your subconscious picking attributes from something you've already seen or felt or touched. Like, I don't think so. God knows what a baby dreams on its first ever night of existence, because it's got nothing to really draw upon. I don't know. Like, that's what my brain's telling
just
me.
Just
like,
a nightmare of coming back out again, just on loop.
That trauma. No, but I don't think you can dream about something that you've never seen anything to do with it. Like, obviously we could dream about dragons because we would have seen a picture of it or something, but they don't exist. Anyway, so I want to talk firstly about the neuroscientist kind of approach and what's actually going on in the brain. And then I'll move on to the psychoanalyst and we'll start. I want you to tell me a dream that you've had and we'll really get into it and, you know, see what it means.
So it was me and you.
Oh my God.
And I don't know how to explain
anyway, so the physical thing. So I'm going to go into a bit about sleep cycle stuff. Do you know about that? You know, REM sleep, light sleep, really know that much kind of like, stuff.
Yeah, I know like the Fitbit tracking thing of REM, sleep and lights, but I don't know much about it. Okay. So
dreams can happen at any time during your sleeping hours, but the most vivid and real dreams are the one during a stage called REM sleep. And REM stands for rapid eye movement. So named because when you're in that state of sleep, your eyes are like darting back and forth across your eyes and you can see it in people. Like, so, you know, if you're sleeping next to your significant other, stay up all night, you'll be able to see them with rapid eye movements going on, which is very weird.
I do that anyway.
Well, you know, I'm just telling the other people that they can do that. So, and we, on average, we dream about 4 to 6 dreams a night. And they can last anywhere from 15 to 40 minutes apiece. Because there's that thing which the logical side of your brain doesn't ever question, which is the timings of your dreams. Like, so you can dream like an hour's worth of material in like 30 seconds. And the only way I can find kind of explain this really simply is the film Inception. So, you know, when they go into each other and it, like the timings get, that is how dreams work.
Dream inside
like
a dream.
Yeah. So,
So your brain can work so fast that I'll literally be dreaming. I'll be in a story for an hour in like how it feels an hour. But it's only been like 15 seconds in real life.
Yeah. So that's why. So when you wake up, so say you've woken up and you actually remember one of the dreams you had that night, a lot of shit can happen in that dream. Yeah. Like you can be like, and then this happened. And then randomly I was in Paris and then I was walking and then so many things can happen. But and one of them is your brain doesn't remember all the things that actually did happen in the dream. You know, there probably was some sort of process from you getting from wherever to Paris in that dream. So you're forgetting large portions of time. But that all happens really fast because you don't need, you know, people walking in front of you in real life and at their speeds to dictate how fast the dream goes. So your brain can work in overdrive mode, so to speak. So yeah, one dream lasts anywhere between 15 to 40 minutes. And then typically that means then you're spending only about 2 hours per night dreaming and away with the fairies.
Do you get into limb movement? Like... leg, like yes. How people walk, and
I'm actually gonna do that right now because this I had the do you ever get like the weird when you're just about to fall asleep? So before I go into the sleep cycle stuff, because I kind of got well sidetracked so far, but you know when like you're falling asleep and like your arm will randomly jerk or your leg or something.
It's my
like
legs,
that.
Yeah.
Legs are the most common. Or the other one is falling, like you feel like you're falling and you suddenly hit the bed and you like you jolt kind of thing. Have you ever had that one?
Not really. I'm more of the leg guy. It's okay. I suddenly like run or something and I'm like, oh, fucking hell. Just I'm getting to sleep.
So that's called a hypnic jerk. And this is where muscles, usually in the legs, that is the most common area, involuntarily contract really quickly. So you get that kind of twitch or spasm. We don't know exactly why the body does it, why it sends that signal out, but the most consensus argument for it is an evolutionary one, which can be either two things. One is, so going back to like when we were cavemen and you are falling asleep somewhere, your brain gives you that sudden jolt and wakes you back up just to do that one last check of, am I safe being asleep here? And you do a quick look around and then you fall back asleep. The other one, which refers to the same kind of period of time when we're cavemen, is if we're falling asleep somewhere which isn't normal, it's not flat. So say you were up in a tree and it jolts you awake just to make sure that, okay, if I move during sleep, I'm not going to fall off this branch. Or like you're on a rock or something like that, and you won't, if you move off that rock, you're not going to fall off a cliff kind of thing. So it's like a, it's your body's defense mechanism kicking into play. But the only other kind of big theory that I found, which is a more modern day one, is it's a transition between your, let's call it the waking brain, handing over to the sleeping brain. And essentially what people are saying is that it gives it up reluctantly, like it doesn't want to sleep. So it's trying to like fight back in and activate the hormones and things that you have when you're awake. But then your sleeping brain's like, nah, we're going to sleep now, bro. I need to recover. and it's just those two kind of consciousness of the brain fighting each other, and get, like, obviously you then sleep wins out, but you can wake up from the jolts as well. I think it's the evolutionary one that makes so much more sense.
I was thinking it's more the one you just described.
Well, there you go. We don't know for certain, obviously. A lot of the dream stuff we don't know for certain, so this is why it's a great topic, because I'm never wrong talking about it. Anyway, so yes, so that's the hypnic jerks. So back to the dreams and the sleep cycles. So recently, actually, they did change the sleep cycle stages down from 5 to 4, but I am going with the more traditional 5-stage sleep pattern. I'm much more of a believer in that approach.
How long have you spent researching this?
I got into some pretty heated forum discussions, I'll tell you. Stage one is your light sleep. So when you just drifted off, and that's typically associated with slow eye movement. So a lot of this is to do with eye movement, which I can't work out what's going on there really. And then that's when your muscles start relaxing, you know, and that's like the first 5%. If you took 8 hours that you sleep per night, the first 5% is that light sleep. Stage two, the eye movement stops altogether, and then your brain waves start to slow down and the amplitude decreases. So, you know, that EEG stuff I was talking about with like the spikes of voltage, those amplitudes will start to drop. And that basically is like the same as your muscles have relaxed, your brain starting to relax. And then stage three, your brain, it starts entering a period called delta waves, and the amplitudes go way back up. So that's kind of like your sleeping brain, I think, coming into full effect now. And that's, so now you're about 50% through your night. So, you know, 8 hours sleep, so you're about 4 hours in, I guess. And then stage four, this is what's known as entering the deep sleep mode. And for all of the sleep cycle experts out here, stages four and three were combined to reduce it from the 5-stage to the 4-stage sleep cycle.
Obviously, and we don't believe in the 4-stage.
Yeah, we don't. I'm still a big firm believer of the 5-stage. And this is where it's very difficult to wake someone up. So when you wake up from stage four, this is when you're like, wait, what's going on? Wait, where am I? What am I going to be doing today? You know, that those kind of like, you wake up, you have no idea.
What are you putting in my bum?
But the, you know, the typical
we're
things.
That.
And then stage five, that's the REM. That's like the deep, you're repairing your muscles, you're repairing your brain. Like that's where shit's going down. And that's your rapid eye movement. And then even breathing becomes more rapid and irregular. And your limbs actually become temporarily paralyzed during that bit of sleep. Like you can't move them.
Yeah, because there's people that get, I don't know if it is it sleep paralysis where you wake up and you can't move. And you,
yeah, I've heard about that.
It's really quite bad.
I don't know what it is. I didn't look into it, this thing. I assume it's like, I don't know, maybe you get woken up directly from REM sleep, but your brain doesn't switch back to actually turning your muscles back on. Because yeah, you are in that REM stage, you can be slightly paralyzed basically. Like you just, you know, rigid, you're, there's no activity going on in your muscles electrically anymore.
So I think it could be like you know you're awake, but you can't really move, but then you still kind of think you're in a dream and it's all a bit weird. And it's never happened to me, but I remember someone telling me about it, but I can't remember who.
That sounds horrible, to be fair.
Yeah, it's pretty bad.
Yeah, shame I didn't look into that, because that's quite fascinating in itself. So during this whole sleep cycle thing that you're going through at the REM stage, your whole brain is then active, like it is active right now in daytime. And the I'll go through the three main parts of the brain and what they're actually doing in terms of making the dream. It's very fascinating when you watch and you see this put coming together, because it is literally the easiest way I can describe it. It is like a film production going on in your head with the different departments of your brain bringing different parts of the dream. And then you see the whole entire dream and like a motion picture kind of thing. So it is fascinating. So first you've got the limbic system. That's the part to deal with emotions in day to day. So when you're then dreaming, this is where all of your emotionally driven associations are being pumped from. It includes the amygdala. So that's the bit just above your spinal cord and your actual brain. So I think it's quite a big connecting part between everything going on in your body. That's where our emotions are centered. So that's where we actually derive meaning from our emotions. So like when we're upset, that part of the brain starts triggering and gains activity, and it's like, oh, upset means this or whatever, or anger means this, and then I react in this way, you know, punch something, whatever it might be. Actually, don't do that. That's probably need to go see anger management if you've got that reaction. And then also to do with like emotional associations. So like when you might see, so like when you see something in the day and you have a memory and then the emotions attached to that memory, that's where it's all getting, that's where all the memory of that emotion's from. So yeah, the limbic system, all about the emotion. And then you've got the cortex, which is responsible for like the contents of the dream. So in my mind, that's like the CGI people. So, you know, the ones, the actual imagery comes from, to the monsters, all the people you've ever seen in your life, your subconscious would sort of drag from there.
So if you have like a really boring dream, it's really the cortex guys just not putting up their end of the bargain. Yeah. On that.
Yeah, they're just like, I don't know, they've not got a lot of people on shift or something.
Like they're just, where's the content?
Yeah, exactly. So and then also like the physics of the dream, so like flying, being chased, that kind of thing, they're responsible for that. And then as I sort of spoke about at the start, you then got the frontal lobe, which, you know, day to day, that's your logical reasoning of the brain, and that's, it's not turned off, but it has the least activity during any part of the day and night is when you're dreaming. And that's why then your brain isn't going, hang on a second, I'm flying right now, how's that possible? It's because basically those people are like not in the office. So the content guy's like, way, anything goes. No, it doesn't have to be real. Let's go. Run it through before they wake up. That's how I'm imagining it. So, you know, a big motion picture production this is. Going on inside your brain every night, which is kind of crazy.
Well, not every night though, because I don't think I dream every night. Or do I dream every night and don't remember?
Yes, no, everyone dreams every night, but you don't remember. Because I've met people that are like, I never dream. And I'm like, after my research, I'm like, actually, I think you do, because that's what studies I've read have told me.
So I know, like, my dad, he says he's never dreamt or doesn't ever dream anymore. Big listener, so big up. So you're telling him he does dream.
He does dream, and it I think age is a big player. Like, as the older you get, the worse you get at remembering the dreams. And it is actually a activity that you can get better at. So you start by, if you do have a dream, writing it down, and your brain can actually get better at remembering your own dreams if you keep on doing it and get into that habit. So it's something you can improve if you wanted to. But, you know, I don't know if you really want to spend time doing that, really. but we do all dream because the brain is active throughout the night. So something is going on. I don't think people aren't just like a black screen or fuzzy screen with nothing going on. There is something happening. You're just not remembering it. And it is to do with the way that. So when you're seeing something in real life, there's a process from going from the eye seeing that into a memory file. And what people think is there's a different path from when you actually make something up in a dream and then you send that to the memory file. And most people, the kind of consensus I was reading was that it is there, we just don't know how to access it. And you know when like you're walking around later in the day and you randomly can remember a dream you had, And sometimes it can be deja vu. Sometimes like you can imagine yourself in a situation, then you are in that situation in real life, and then you've got deja. Like you can sometimes access dreams later on in life. And so that's why people think they are stored somewhere, but our brain is just really bad at actually remembering where it's stored, so to speak.
That deja vu one is weird though. I don't know. I really don't get it. Because there's times where you're like, wait a sec.
But, yeah, you remember it. Like you really remember being there.
It's strange. Yeah. I don't get it.
But. I only went into a little bit, and the reason I didn't go full into it is because I actually think it'd be a really good topic for a whole episode because there's a lot on it. But one of them is when I'll get into like the types of dreams that we have and the psychoanalysis bit. One of the reasons people think we dream is to prepare for future events. Like, okay, if I'm in this event and it happens, how am I going to react? And your brain kind of plays through scenarios. And then people are saying deja vu is when you've kind of scratched the surface of that dream that you had, which you've then got a memory of, but it's not in like your normal memory files of your brain. It's in the dream section. And it's sort of making that weird connection. And that's where you go like, wait, what? Like, it can be the simple stuff of like walking down a street, you get deja vu. And it's basically that a week ago you had a dream and your brain, you didn't remember it at the time when you woke up, but your brain just put you in that street walking down it for like, I don't know, 20 minutes of the dream. And then you did something crazy, like flew off. But so your brain...
The cortex guys wasn't doing their job for 20 minutes
No, yeah, exactly. And it's that kind of weird connection of your brain. Like it knows there's something going, it knows that it has a memory of it, but it's not a real memory. And that's the whole deja vu-ness going on. But I think it's definitely a whole topic in itself because that's interesting. Or it's a simulation and, you know, it's a glitch.
Yeah, definitely.
So who knows? So, yeah, I guess that's all the neuroscientific kind of aspects to it. You know, what's going on? Why is it going on kind of thing? Let's get more into the psychoanalytic stuff, which in itself is ridiculously interesting. You picked that up, didn't you? I fumbled that word.
Like what?
The psychoanalytic side of it, if you really want to know.
Yeah.
So, why do we dream? And the honest answer is that we yet do not know why we do this, why our brains put these images and things in our head. But over the years, because it's been studied for hundreds, thousands of years now, people have come up with a lot of reasons. So I was just going to shoot through those quickly. So one of the most famous psychologists, Sigmund Freud, if you've ever heard of him.
Oh, yeah. One of my favorites.
Yeah. but his big focus and belief was that dreams reveals a person's unconscious desires or thoughts or motivations. So like society doesn't let you think or behave in certain ways in most ways for good reason. So your brain... if you did actually have those motivations, something, your brain has to release those urges in some sort of way. So this is quite a dark approach to the subconscious and things. Freud thought dreams were a way for people to satisfy urges and desires that weren't acceptable to society.
So if people have like dreams of cheating on their other halves and stuff.
Yeah. So, I mean, what I'm going to end this whole thing is don't try to read into your dreams, because they can mean so many different things depending on whatever, and like it can come from different places in your brain for different reasons. So you just went there for the desire to cheat on your partner, right?
No, I'm not saying I dream of that. Just want to clarify. Okay. Just saying if people thought that.
Sorry to
asking for a friend. Asking for a friend.
Okay. I mean, okay, you know the other dream you get where you've cheated on your partner and you wake up and you feel really guilty, you're like, oh my God, what did I do? There's the two ways that you can look at it, which is the one which is, you know, the Freud method, which is like you look at it of like your brain, you want to cheat or like you want to be with other people kind of thing, and your brain satisfies that urges by constructing this dream world for you to do that in. But then also that dream can actually mean that you're not very secure in the relationship and you're worried that person might leave you, and so it's a defense mechanism. So a single dream can have so many different interpretations, and we don't know why your subconscious is bringing it into the dream, so you can't really find a definitive answer of like, why did that dream mean that? So my biggest thing to everyone, from what I've read anyway, is don't Google your dreams when you wake up and then, you know, act on them in real life. Because, like, you know, if you've got a dream, it's like, oh, you must not feel safe at work. Don't try and do something at work, like, because you don't know why your brain's thinking it and pulling it into the dream. It could be any number of reasons. And then you act on it in real life, and then it turns into an even worse situation in real life. So
a real nightmare.
A nightmare indeed. Yeah. So don't do it. And that's, I guess, comes into the next bit about like, why do we dream? And another big one that people say is it's kind of a way for our brain to consolidate and process all the information of the day. So all the feelings that we felt, all the people that we saw, it's kind of like filing it away. So dreamland is like a big time for like the admin team of your brain to get to work and start filing this all away correctly. And, you know, they're just showing that as it goes. I'm really all about having little people inside your brain doing everything. That's
what is
like
that film?
My analogy.
What is that film of the little people inside the head?
Wait, Inside Out cartoon?
Yeah, that's it. That's
Inside Out. Yeah. Great film. Yeah, that's what I'm imagining. That's actually how, and I think that's a really good way to visualize the brain, to be honest. I imagine if there's any neuroscientists listening to us, you're screaming your head off at that comment, but I think that's a really good way to visualize it. Yeah, so consolidating, processing information, essentially mental housekeeping. Another one is for more sort of trauma side of things or more extreme emotional responses that you've had in the day, it processes them in it's kind of like a psychotherapy for your brain to process what's been going on and why things happened. So it's very important for us to sleep and to get to those dreams, because a lot does happen in terms of activity in the brain. But then the other big thing is that dreams don't mean anything. And it's just it's just a result of the random signals firing off in your brain. And that's why dreams are so random, why they feel so fleeting and changing from 1 minute to the next. It's not that we don't remember the whole time frame. It's just that they're random signals firing for whatever reason, and our brain's trying to interpret them in this kind of unconscious, subconscious sleeping state.
Thing is, I think with that last one, it's, I'd agree, but then at the same time, if you have a recurring dream, you think it would be for some kind of reason.
Yeah.
I know you're going to go through the, recurring ones.
Yeah, so we have a lot of, when people are part of these studies and they say what their dreams was to the researchers and stuff, a lot of them do overlap. If not the details, the actual theme of it does overlap. And one of the biggest ones is teeth falling out. And I've had this so many times, like especially stress, like before exam season, every night my teeth are like falling out.
Yeah, I get it when it's weird. My teeth like crack in like to pieces, and then they start like, I start pulling them out.
It's just horrible, that's so mad.
It makes me feel like horrible even thinking about it, because it's like, oh no.
Mine is that I like, you know, when like you grind your teeth or something, you move your bottom jaw all the way to the left. What happens is I move it far over and then it gets like trapped up behind the top set of jaw. And then I'm like stuck there in the dream going, oh no, what am I going to do? Yeah. And then I finally like just pull my jaw back across. It pulls out all the top teeth and the bottom teeth. And I'm like stood there with my teeth in my hands looking at them. And it freaks me out so much. Like I hate it. It's the worst dream. Yeah, I get it like once a week, I swear. I get it.
And it's like my jaw is like really clenching hard. I can't unclench. And then my teeth like start cracking. And it's just horrible.
So this is the thing about, we don't know why we dream these things, because that can be stress related. And for me, I feel like it is stress related because it always crops up when I'm stressed, like, you know, exam season or something like that. But it also could be that you're grinding your teeth in real life while you're sleeping, and then your brain's feeling that and it's just pumping that into the dream. So it's got nothing to do with stress, anxiety or whatever the other way might be. It's just something it's pulling from real life. So we don't know what dreams mean. Yeah.
Yeah. I think that second one's probably more likely for me, because I don't feel like I'm that stressed at the moment.
Oh, you think,
but I still get that dream. So I reckon, because like that was my thought, like, oh, I guess I'm just clenching my jaw really hard when I'm asleep. And then it's like just cracking my teeth in my dream. But
Yeah. And then so you've got that. So then that signal in your brain of my teeth being clenched together is being fired through your brain. And then maybe it is a bit of that. Why do we dream? The third reason of your brain's just trying to make sense of the random signals that are popping off when you're in this sleeping state. And it's just interpreting in any way. But I mean, for the teeth falling out, because this is the biggest one I researched, because it's my biggest dream. It can be some people. I mean, there's lots of different reasons it could be. But one is reflect anxieties about your appearance and how others perceive you. It might not be perception in terms of looks. It could be perception in terms of authority. If like you're a new boss at work, how's the team going to feel to me? That can then be fed back in terms of a bad teeth dream. It can also be personal loss. So death, end of a relationship, moving house, that kind of thing. There's so many reasons for the same dream that I do say don't go Googling your dreams, because you'll see something and you'll be like, oh, it's going to be that then. And you might associate and then it's not actually that. So, yeah. Another big one, being chased. That's quite a common one. You know, when you're, like, you're stuck on the spot as well and you can't move. Yeah. So your logistic side of your brain, that frontal lobe ain't pulling its weight then, because, you know, obviously I'd move if I'm going to use my legs. Apparently that's the most common one, is reflecting when in real life you're running away from a situation that's causing you fear or anxiety. So I don't know, maybe you've got a big meeting at work that you've not actually prepared fully for. So you're just really worried about that. You want to run away from it, kind of thing. Or maybe physically you are running away from something in real life. And then your dreams just taking on that kind of abstract thought. Naked in public. I've never had that one. The only closest I've come to it is, which is another big one I'll get into, about exams, where I've turned up to exams and then I realise I've got no trousers on, but I'm not naked. I've just literally got everything on apart from trousers, and I'm sat there at the desk and it's well weird, and I'm like very embarrassed and I don't do the exam because I'm too embarrassed and I fail it. So I've never had one where I'm like stark naked in the public place, but that is a very common one.
Yeah, I don't think about that.
But then another one, exams, where like you'll sit in the dream, you're sitting down to take an exam, and that can have ridiculously number of reasons. Like you've got a big event coming up to prepare for, whatever it might be. Flying. I think I've flown in a few dreams. How about you?
I wish I had. I feel like that would be the dream. That's my one dream that I never get to dream.
Well, what you need to do, as one study showed, is they took 15 people, right? They got them, half of them, not to do anything before they went to bed. But the other half, they said, don't think about this before you go to bed. And obviously, what does your brain do? You might not try to actively think it, but your brain's going to think it. And then literally almost all of them then had that in their dream that night. So, mate, if you try not to think about flying tonight, you might have a flying dream for the first time in your life.
I like that. Yeah, I'll try.
Yeah.
I'll report back.
So the last big one, falling off a big building, falling off something high, and just that weirdness of like free falling. Apparently that's, I don't think I've had that one though, actually. Apart, the only closest is when like you jolt awake in bed, because I do fall in bed a lot and then suddenly I hit the ground.
I feel like me and you are very similar.
We're great minds.
Was it made from the same cloth?
Yeah.
The same.
Yeah. A few last notes then. The reason that we forget dreams, because we forget 95% of them. The most logical answer I found actually for that, for the reason of doing it, whatever that might be, is so that we can actually still tell the difference between our memories in real life and our memories in a dream. Because it'd be really bad if we couldn't sort of like realize which was which. You know, like when you have a dream of like your partner cheating on you or something, and like you'll wake up kind of like, the fuck? And then you'll be like, oh yeah, no, that was a dream actually, weren't it? But imagine if we can't do that and our brain couldn't work out, and you know, we did remember everything perfectly. You might act on your dreams and then you realize I'm acting on a dream and not real life. So there's just sort of a logical reason that we don't remember. And then just, yeah, that little bit about the connection between how our memory system in the brain works and then how the dream is produced, you know, with all the different departments, as I said, working together. And we just don't know how to access them. So they are stored in a memory, but they just can't be recalled. yeah, so I think just to end all that, really, don't get hung up over your dreams and what they mean. Try to enjoy them.
What about nightmares?
Nightmares, yeah.
It's a whole nother ball game.
It's a whole different ball game. No, I did look into it a little bit, but they're just dreams where the limbic system is particularly pulling on the negative emotions that you have, fear, anxiety, stress, all that kind of stuff. And there can be loads of different reasons. Illness is a big one. So when you're under the weather, you're much more likely to have nightmares. Medication or drugs that you're on, anxiety and stress. I should have looked into that. Damn, I didn't.
Yeah, apparently.
Yeah, that's that thing, isn't it? Yeah. I can't believe that's... I feel like that is... It's so much of a myth that it's become fact. So everyone thinks it's going to happen. And then
placebo, isn't it?
Yeah. So, you know, when I was talking about try not to think about something before you go to bed, and then you'll think and then you'll dream it, or the kind of other side of it. That's it with cheese. Like, oh, I've eaten cheese, I'm going to have a horrible nightmare. And then your brain's thinking about nightmares before you go to sleep, so you then have a nightmare. So
maybe.
Yeah. Dreams are conjured from just so many different things going on in your head. And it's just this weird relationship between your subconscious and your conscious. And the biggest thing is your subconscious is such an abstract thing. Like, we have no idea what it is. So you can't really take anything away from what it is. Dreams. There you go.
What a dream that topic was.
Hey, nice.
Sound like I planned that for the last 40 minutes to say at the end.
You wrote it down just to be ready. Yeah.
I thought that's so many questions. I feel like we really need like a dream expert to come on and just
so
be
cool.
Like, tell me what so about cool. this. Tell me what about that.
Yeah. Because it is fascinating.
Yeah. Because everyone experienced it, and everyone, I guarantee people listening will be like,
I've had a teeth falling out.
They'll have
dream.
Questions.
Yeah.
And they'll be like, oh, what about this dream? Or why? What? But no, this isn't for me. Or I feel like everyone's different with it.
Yeah, no, it's true. And what would be sick is if we actually had planned guests and then said, oh, we've got a dream expert next week, send in questions, and then we could ask them.
And, well, if any of our listeners are a dream expert, please get in touch. And we'll,
please get in touch. I also, this is the first time I'm going to do this, a shout out to a listener. This out to Villis, who's been listening, and he's part of our Latvian followers, because we know we're international on this thing.
Global.
So yeah, just wanted to shout that name out. Maybe we'll shout out a name each week, you know.
Yeah, you're going to make this a president now. Because, you know, we've got some diehard fans that want to get a shout out.
True. From around the world.
Yeah. How was your drink? Did you like your, was it tequila, what was it?
Sours? No, whiskey sours. What were you going to say, tequila sunrise?
I don't know where I was going with that.
Whiskey sours. It was good. I recommend it to anyone. If you like whiskey, go for it.
And was the egg whites, did you notice the difference with the egg whites?
Well, I've never had it without, you know what? Oh, that's a bit of a cop-out, really, to do another week without egg whites, because it's the same drink, really. But maybe I will do that comparison and get back to you.
Yeah, let's not do it next week. But
and how was your sangria, the rosé version?
Well, I'm two glasses
down. Not so alpha way.
It's nice. You know, all I'm picturing myself is on a beach in Barcelona with a jug of sangria.
Yeah, we can't do that because of COVID.
Yeah, with a mic.
Bro, you've talked a lot about us being together in this episode.
Mate, it was in my dream, all right?
It was in a dream, yeah.
Dream. It means nothing.
Read into that. Make sure you read into that a lot. Right. Anyway, make sure to go follow us on Instagram. We'll get a load of bougie photos up for this week's to explain everything. It's going to be quite good. Anything else to add, Tobes?
No, I think you've nailed it on the head with the bougie photos, to be honest. So.
Yeah. Oh, I should say, at Not So Alpha Males. That's where you'll find us on Instagram.
And are we gonna have an episode for a couple of weeks' time? I don't know.
We're gonna try. Our lives are quite busy and packed at the moment, but I think we'll try and get back onto it now. Unfortunately, everyone, this first season's only gonna have 10 episodes, and this is episode 8 now. So we're slowly getting there, but we'll be back.
And the episode 10 is gonna be a special one, isn't it?
Episode 10 is very special. Can't wait for that. Yeah. It might actually make or break this whole thing. We might not do season 2 because we'll be too angry at each other. It's a competition, basically. But more on that later.
All right. I'll see you later.
See you later, guys.